Our goal in this series and in this session is to explore spiritual and religious resistance in the Holocaust. And for those who are returning, you know we've done this from different vantage points in different contexts. And today, being that we are just a few days before Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the Jewish New Year, I wanted to explore with you together the topic of the high holidays in the Holocaust. Now, anytime we talk about religious life in the Holocaust, we think about the remarkable heroism of people who were committed to that religious identity and that religious practice because it came with a tremendous amount of hardship. First of all, of course, there was the practical, physical hardship. There was the emotional hardship. And then there's the spiritual hardship. And I think that when you think about that same set of challenges and put it in the context of the high holidays, it becomes even more magnified. Because what is the high holidays about? The holidays of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are about connecting and reconnecting with God. And so how do you connect and reconnect with God in a circumstance that is challenging and it's incomprehensible and it's brutal and you could fill in all the adjectives? So what we're going to explore today are a couple of snippets. This is not meant to be an exhaustive presentation, but a survey of a few times and a few figures and a few cities of people who did and were able to reconnect and find a way to create a spiritual resistance in the high holidays. So by doing that, I want to start kind of at the beginning of the war, make our way through the war a little bit, and reflect on some different people who can share this experience. And as we've done in the past, we're going to try as much as possible to focus on primary documents, which means documents that are written by the principals either at the time, and some of them will be written later than the time. So I want to start, just get right into it. At the beginning of the war, we know that the war broke out in September 1939, which was just before the high holidays. And we have this volume, this very important work, called Kiddush Hashem by Rabbi Shimon Huberband. Rabbi Shimon Huberband was a member of the Oneg Shabbos archives in Warsaw. And his job was to document religious life, traditional religious Jewish life in the Holocaust. He was based in the Warsaw ghetto. Much of his materials were saved. A lot of it was not. He himself was murdered by the Nazis. He was killed by the Germans. But before he was killed, he succeeded in documenting many things that happened. And for those who recall, who were here in the past, we've looked at different angles of those, and each one of them is incredible. So what he describes now on page one, this is an English translation of the original. The original was written in Yiddish, and we have many of those papers in Yad Vashem. They have the archives with the original mimeograph of the Yiddish text. And then they were translated to Hebrew, now to English. He's now, at the beginning of the war, outside of Warsaw, in a town called Pietrzykow. Pietrzykow is a very important Polish town. One of the significant features of this town, in terms of religious life, is that many religious books were published in Pietrzykow.
Is that the Russian?
It's near Warsaw, so it's in Poland. Pietrzykow was also, for those who are keeping score, many of you are familiar with the former chief rabbi of Israel, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau. So Rabbi Lau has a beautiful autobiography. It's in Hebrew called Al Tishlach Yad Fa'el Anar, and in English it's called something else. I don't remember what it's called. Something Out of the Depths, that's it. Called Out of the Depths. So in there he describes that his father, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lau, was the final Rav of Pietrzykow, who went with his community to Treblinka. You know, many of the Warsaw Jews were taken to Treblinka. So this community in Pietrzykow was taken to Treblinka with Rabbi Lau. So at the outset of the war, Rav Shimon Huberband found himself in Pietrzykow for Rosh Hashanah. So he writes for us what it was like Rosh Hashanah 1939 in Pietrzykow. So start. You see on page one, left-hand side, he describes how the mikveh keeper heated the mikveh. So Jews, I'm on the third paragraph, Jews had to get to the mikveh to immerse themselves. Many men have the practice to immerse themselves on Erev, or the day before Rosh Hashanah. So they would get to the mikveh early, before 8 o'clock, when the roundups would start. Second column, you see on the left-hand column, fourth paragraph. On the first day of Rosh Hashanah, 5700, close to 20 Jews gathered in the synagogue. The rabbi didn't attend, the cantor didn't lead the prayers, and the length of the service was shortened considerably. There were no services in the Beis Medrash or in the Hasidic Shtiblach. The latter were occupied by residents of the streets whose buildings had been burned down. What were they burned down in? Close. At the beginning of the war with the German advance. Right, the Blitzkrieg crushed most of these Polish towns. So they were taking a refuge in the Shtiblach. In many buildings, he writes, prayers were held in private apartments. And now he describes his own personal circumstance. Such was the case in our apartment. We began at about 6 a.m. The participants were neighbors from the courtyard and a few Jews from the adjacent houses. So take a pause for a moment and think for one thing. Next week, there are going to be hundreds and thousands of Jews around the world who are going to get up, many of them at 6 o'clock in the morning, to do exactly this. So this is a tradition that is unbroken, even in the craziest of circumstances. But in this circumstance, there is an ethical dilemma. There's a tension. What's the tension? Because if you have a little minyan, a quorum of 10 men davening in your apartment, and people come from the neighbor, what are you worried about?
Being taught.
You might be found out. Yeah. You might be discovered. So he describes how within the community, within this apartment, the residents of our courtyard spoke angrily against the outsiders who had come. They didn't want people from the nearby buildings because they might attract attention. How long do the prayers take on Rosh Hashanah? Let's say Shacharis, the morning prayer. How long does it take?
45 minutes.
On Rosh Hashanah?
On Rosh Hashanah day?
Yeah, Rosh Hashanah day in the morning.
The entire morning or just Shacharis?
Just chakras.
An hour and a half,
right? 2 hours, maybe. He describes how chakras took a half hour. And they didn't blow the shofar. Why didn't they blow the shofar? That's it. So here you have a religious conundrum. On the one hand, you have the mitzvah, the commandment for tekiah shofar. On the other hand, you have the overriding principle of preservation of life. So on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, he describes that they didn't blow the shofar. Musaf lasted a half hour. By 7:30, the prayers were over. I suspect there are people who didn't complain about that. And at this time, he describes, remember, this is just at the outbreak, everybody had food. But he says, who could eat? Nobody was in the mood to eat. Who's going to have a festive meal when the Germans are marching outside? What happened the second day? Take a look on the right-hand column. On the second day, they began to pray at the crack of dawn. I'm on the second column, it's number 41, bottom paragraph, after the quarreling about who's coming and who's not coming. After Shacharis, which took slightly less than half an hour, we decided that today, the second day of Rosh Hashanah, we would blow the shofar. So you can imagine the sacrifice and the commitment. And what does he describe? He says, we decided to do so in the following manner. Everyone would enter the chamber in my apartment, which was located in the corridor leading to the yard. The door would be covered on the inside by a blanket, and only 10 sounds would be released from the shofar. Tekiah, which is the long blast, Shvarim, which is the 3 middle-sized blasts, Trua, the 9 short blasts, and then another Tekiah, and then a following set of Tekiah Shvarim Tekiah, and Tekiah Teruah Tekiah, which is basically the ultimate minimum one could do to fulfill the biblical requirement. And that is what we did. The shofar blower made all efforts to blow as softly as possible. When the quote-unquote job was done, we all felt greatly relieved. We read from the Torah, quickly recited the Musaf prayers, and dispersed before 8 a.m., each to his own hiding place.
They're not doing any roundups at this point, the Germans.
So it's hard to tell. They're definitely pulling Jews off the street, and he describes how there were people who were grabbed and taken, but it's not the same. It's right at the beginning. So there are no formal labor camps. There's no ghetto yet. This is just at the beginning when the Germans are prowling the streets of Pietrikov. This is just at the beginning. What does it look like 1 year later? So let's turn the page and meet a man by the name of Chaim Kaplan, who authored this volume called Scroll of Agony. And this is his diary, the Warsaw Diary of Chaim A. Kaplan. So we're going from Pietrikov into the big city of Warsaw. Now Warsaw, of course, was, maybe you could say, the most prominent Jewish city in all of Poland and maybe even all of Europe. So what are things like now in 19... What's that?
Lodz.
I think Warsaw had more.
Warsaw.
I think
more. Yeah.
I think there were more Jews in Warsaw. I don't remember the number offhand. At the height of the ghetto, there were more than 400,000 Jews in the ghetto.
Yeah.
But before the war, I'm trying to remember the numbers.
One third of the whole city was Jewish.
No. Yeah.
And it was about 1.2 or 1.3.
Something like that.
Citizens of 400,000.
At the height, it was 400,000 in the ghetto before the mass deportations in 1942. So now, we're still early in the war, which means we're even before the Warsaw Ghetto. Right now, there's just persecution, but we haven't sealed off the Jewish community into a ghetto. So Chaim Kaplan describes, bottom left.
What page are...
Well, I'm on page 3 now, where it says Scroll of Agony. Warsaw, 1940. We have no public worship even on the high holidays. There is darkness in our synagogues, for there are no worshipers. Silence and desolation within, and sorrow looking on from without. Even for the high holy days, there was no permission for communal worship. Now listen to the next sentence. Interesting question. Again, another kind of ethical dilemma. I don't know whether the Judenrat made any attempt to obtain it. But if it didn't try, it was only because everyone knew in advance that the request would be turned down. So here you have another question of what role does the Judenrat play in the lives of the Jews in the neighborhood and in what religious context? You know, the Judenrat was predominantly not observant, but there were, in very many cases, in different places, members who were rabbinic figures as well. Even in the darkest days of our exile, we were not tested with this trial. Never before was there a government so evil that it would forbid an entire people to pray. But never before in our history, drenched in tears and blood, did we have so cruel and barbaric an enemy. Everything is forbidden to us. The wonder is that we are still alive and that we do everything. And this is true of public prayer too.
Does this include the Romans?
So it's interesting. So what Debbie's pointing out is that, wait a second, is it actually true that nobody ever before prohibited Jews from praying?
Right.
So I think this is not a, it's not a historian writing,
okay.
It's a Jew writing, and this is his perception.
Got it.
It could be that in Roman times, and we know from many Talmudic descriptions, and we know from the story of Hanukkah,
right,
that there were such severe religious persecutions. But what you're seeing, and what's so powerful about a primary document, is that you're seeing this is what this person was thinking and was experiencing from the inside at that time. So what he's saying is, there is no prayer, but there is. Top next column. Secret minyanim by the hundreds throughout Warsaw organized services. And in this case, unlike what we heard about in Pietrikov, and this, by the way, speaks to the fact that you can't really give one brushstroke as to what religious life was going on in the Holocaust. It's not like there's one thing that was happening. It's not one size fits all. You had people who were observing and people who weren't. You had people who were observing fully and then you had partial. It's not one size fits all, which is why it's good to get a kind of a spectrum of views. There was not even a shortage of sermons. Everything is in accordance with the ancient customs of Israel. When there is no informer at work, the enemy doesn't know what is going on. And we can assume that no Jewish man, even if he is a Jew born in Poland, would inform on Jews standing before their Maker in prayer.
Why would he say even a Jew born in Poland?
Interesting.
Where was he born?
Where else were they born?
Where was
great question. So I wonder if it has to do with the fact that there were some informers who were getting favors from Polish policemen, but I'm not sure. It's a good question. They pick some inside room whose windows look out onto the courtyard and pour out their supplications before the God of Israel in whispers. This time there are no cantors and choirs, only whispered prayers. But the prayers are heartfelt. It is possible to weep in secret too, and the gates of tears are not locked. So here you have average pedestrian individual who is invoking a Talmudic passage. The Talmud has an expression that says sometimes the gates of prayer are locked, but the gates of tears are never locked. And you can see how this Talmudic expression kind of seeps its way into the cultural mindset of this average, ordinary Jew, Chaim Kaplan, living in Warsaw. And so we give praise to the God of Israel, and here we find yet another religious struggle. And what is he quoting? Quote, who kept us alive and supported us and brought us unto this season. What is he talking about? That's right. Some of us recall in an earlier session we quoted the same question from Rabbi Yehoshua Moshe Aronson in the Kunin work camp on Passover, when a man came over to him and said, how can we say the bracha of Shehecheyanu? So this is the question. How can you say that God has sustained us and brought us to this day if it's a life of misery? So what does he write? During the year, many individuals drank the cup of hemlock. Many have gone to their graves. The community has been debased and impoverished, but it still exists. And so what's the implication? That we have to say Shehecheyanu just for the fact that we're still here. Nobody in today's day and age would have the audacity or the temerity to say something like that about a period like that. And yet, someone who was living it at the time, that's what they said. That's how they viewed it. It's incredible. Shehecheyanu even to live in that time. So I want to fast forward to a different context. We're fast forwarding now to page 4. We're out of the cities, we're out of the ghettos, we're into the camps, and we know there are different experiences, and we'll get to kind of a survey in a minute, but I want to bring us up to date to Auschwitz 1944 on Rosh Hashanah. So you know, by 1944 in the fall, who are the overwhelming people pouring into Auschwitz? Right? Hungarian Jews. Okay. Many of these Hungarian Jews were extremely pious. Many were Hasidic. Most of them were, at least community-wise, most of them were observant. So they're piling into Auschwitz. And who is there at this time? One of the people in Auschwitz was a rabbi who later settles in Chicago. His name was Rabbi Zvi Hirsch Meisels. He was from a small Hungarian town called Weizen, which is why in West Rogers Park there is a school called the Weizener Cheder. Weizener is named after the Weizener Rav of Zvi Hirsch Meisels, who came to Chicago and settled here after the war, and he was known as the Weizener Rav from this town in Hungary, Weizen. He wrote a responsive volume in Hebrew called Mekadshei Hashem, those who sanctify the name of God. And he was one of the myriad of Hungarian Jews who were taken to Auschwitz straight from Hungary. He arrives in Auschwitz and he describes, now I'm giving you the original in English, which is a translation of a piece in Hebrew called, the Hebrew edition is called Shar Machmadim. It was published here in Chicago. Someone gave it to me as a gift, which was really nice. It was published in 2004, which was from the front of his volume about issues that came up in the Holocaust, Mekadshei Hashem. So in his introduction, he tells you some of the stories, some of the things that happened to him. And if he wouldn't have been alive and describing this with his own words, and living in Chicago and telling us, people would say, I wouldn't even believe it. So here you are in Auschwitz in the fall of 1944, and he describes how somehow he had a chauffeur in Auschwitz, which is already something very unusual. And he describes a particular roundup. You know, in Auschwitz, there were different sections. There was a work camp. There was Auschwitz, Birkenau, and then a small one, Buna. So there were Jews who were in the work detail. There were Jews who were going to go immediately to their death. And then you had selections. So he describes at length, which I'm not going to focus on right now, that there was a particular selection of 1,400 boys who were then isolated in a hut, in a barracks, where they were obviously going to be taken away to the gas chambers. And there became a whole discussion among boys that he knew from his town, from his yeshiva, his own students, about, well, you know, one boy comes to him and says, you know, there's one of the brightest boys. He's brighter than I am. I want to know, Rebbe, is it okay if I take his place? That I should go in there and he should come out because he was a much greater student. At least he should see if he could survive. An unbelievable description of what's going on. And Rabbi Meisel knows these boys because they're from his community. So then he gets word, someone sends a word from this barracks that they heard that he had a chauffeur.
Who's he?
That Rabbi Meisel's had a chauffeur in Auschwitz, and these 1,400 boys who are corralled in this barrack would like him to blow the chauffeur for them. So here you have a halachic quandary, a religious question. On the one hand, the Torah says you can't give up your life for the mitzvah of shofar. So like we saw earlier, if it's a dangerous situation, so you don't blow the shofar. On the other hand, he felt compelled into these circumstances to do what he had to do. So he describes how he took his son and he had him as a lookout and he says, we're going to go to this barrack over there. If he was a teenager at that time. You're going to stand outside, he says to him, if you see anything suspicious or anybody coming, you call me right away, and I'm going to go and blow the shofar for these boys. And this is where we pick it up. There was not a writer or poet in the entire world who can portray my feelings as I entered the sealed barracks. It was only due to the miracle of God that my heart did not burst in anguish when I saw before me the bitter sea of tear-stung eyes. All of the children were screaming and crying terribly with burning tears and raised voices that ascend up to the heart of heaven. And they all pressed forward to kiss my hand, my clothing, any place they could touch me. They cried out with the simple but heart-wrenching words, Rebbe, Rebbe, oh, have mercy! Many of them I knew they had been my students or my congregants. When I began reciting the verse Min HaMeitzar, from the straits I did call upon God, which is the traditional verse, I'm parenthetically, that's the traditional verse that the shofar blower will recite before blowing the shofar, and you can see the double entendre here, that literally from the straits you're calling out to God. They interrupted and begged me to stay a few words before the shofar service. Too agitated by their overwhelming sorrow to speak, I was unable to move my lips or force my tongue to speak. In addition, I was afraid of the delay. It was getting late, the sun was setting, and the SS men could arrive at any moment. But the boys would not let me continue, and at last I relented. I spoke words of drush, which means a homily, focusing on the verse, Bakese Liyom Chagenu. Bakese Liyom Chagenu is a biblical verse that means that on the appointed time, it is in hiding. In hiding. Who is in hiding at this time? The Ribbono Shel Olam, God Himself. This is what the Weizen Rav is telling these condemned boys. Explaining that truly Hashem's design and purpose for the Holocaust was, at this moment, hidden and concealed from us. But we are not to despair, for as the Gemara in Brachos number 10a tells us, even if a sharp sword rests on one's throat, he should not refrain from praying for mercy. Turn to the next page. You can read the rest on your own. So he blows the shofar for the boys, and then, bottom left column on page 5, after blowing the blowing of the shofar, as I was about to leave, one boy stood before me and cried out in great anguish, Dearest of friends, The rabbi has strengthened us by telling us that even when a sharp sword is upon our throats, we should not despair of mercy. But I say to you, we can hope for the best, but we must prepare for the worst. For the sake of Hashem, my brothers, let us not forget in our last moments to cry out, Shema Yisrael, with sincere devotion. With heart-rending voices and burning passion, they cried out, Shema Yisrael. Then another boy stepped forward and said, we are not to give the Rebbe a yashar koach for his great mesiras nefesh, which means sacrifice, in providing us with our last mitzvah, that of the shofar blowing. But all of us will bless you that in this merit, God will help that the Rebbe will merit to leave this place alive and well. And all the boys answered in unison, Amen. He's about to leave, and what does some of the boys ask him for? They asked him for a morsel of bread. Why are they looking for a morsel of bread? They know they're going to be taken to the gas chambers in a little while and they're fasting. Why do they want to eat a bracha today? What do they want to have? They want to have a Rosh Hashanah meal. They want to be able to fulfill the mitzvah of having a festive meal on Rosh Hashanah in a condemned barrack in Auschwitz. It's unbelievable. If that is not the most incredible religious resistance, I don't know what is. And he describes how from that fast day, they couldn't get back to the barracks, they couldn't get them any bread, and they were taken from there to the crematorium. And this is only one incident of other incidents. And some of this is documented in this volume. You'll turn the page. It's called Hidden in Thunder. It's a secondary source. It's a very important compendium. You can get it easily in English. It originally was published in Hebrew, called Beseser Ra'am, Hidden in Thunder, by Esther Farbstein, a prominent, very important Holocaust historian today. And so she describes in Volume 2 the similar phenomenon of people praying in various camps. And take a look on the left side of page, on page 6 here in the book, it's 426 in the second paragraph. There were also women who dictated the text of the prayers as they remembered them from home. Because how are people praying on the high holidays if they don't have a machzor, if they don't have a prayer book? The answer is, there were pious women who memorized the text from before the war, and people had little scraps of paper or whatever they could to put together a makeshift prayer book. In Gross Rosen, which was not a death camp, it was a concentration camp in Germany, for example, an old woman from Warsaw, the wife of a cantor, reconstructed the Rosh Hashanah prayers from memory. And they describe how, and she describes here, that you find pages of these prayer books in various places, including a Rosh Hashanah prayer book that was recently reprinted. So it's not just isolated in this one incident of Rabbi Meisel's. It's happening in many places that Jews, men and women, are clinging to their faith and observing even the liturgy from before the war. It's incredible. So I want to conclude with one unique, very unusual document. It appears, the introduction to that document you have here, which is on page 7. This document that you have on page 7 is something that you can find in Yad Vashem online, which is where I got this from. This is, you see what language this is?
French.
That's right. So if anybody here speaks French, that would be great, but I didn't get anybody to translate it, and my French is, I would say, I don't want to say it's substandard, because that would, you know, make it seem as if I did have some French. I studied French Jewish history in Paris for a few weeks. My parents sent me, which was very nice, but basically the only things I learned how to say is right, left, and which way is the bathroom. Où se trouve la toilette? That's all you need, because they refuse to speak any English. So what is this? What is this page? What is this document? Anybody recognize it? It's hard because it's in French and Hebrew.
Meteorology of some sort.
Okay.
Testament?
That's right.
It's what?
It's the...
Daf Eid. It's a page of testimony. Yad Vashem has countless pages of testimony from various people. So this is a page of testimony about somebody who was murdered in the Holocaust. See, it says Daf 8 on the top, Yad Vashem. When was it signed? So here you see it says 1980. That's what it looks like to me. Or maybe it's 1960. It's hard to say. But it's signed by, you see where it says signature, right here where my finger is? What does that name say? It's hard to make it out. The signature says Talmud David. So the man who's submitting this testimony is a man by the name of David Talmud. I think someone's trying to get it. Who is he describing? This is, and if you, by the way, if you want to find out about a Holocaust victim, you go on the Yad Vashem website, you go to the database, and you put in the name of the person and their city. Well, how do they have information about all these people? Because they collect testimony over decades. So I think it says 1980, but I'm not even sure. Who is David Talmud? He is the brother of the man listed in the page here. Talmud, prenom. What's prenom in French? I don't know, because it says in Hebrew, Shem Prati, so it's first name. His name was Tzvi Elimelech. Tzvi Elimelech, which is not an uncommon Hasidic name. Also, people would call him in Yiddish, you know what his nickname would be? He would be called Hirsch. Tzvi would be called Hirsch. So in Yiddish, his name was Hirsch Melech, Tzvi Elimelech, last name Talmud. Where was he born? He was born in Glogov in what year? There you go. 1912. His mother's name was? Regina. His father's name was?
Israel
Leib. Okay, where did he live?
Glogov in France.
No, Glogov in Poland.
Poland.
Where did he live? Lublin. Exactly. He's living in Lublin, this man, Reb Tzvi Elimelech Talmud. At the time that the Nazis, that the Germans invaded in September of 1939, he is one of the five functioning rabbis in the city of Lublin. He's not just a rabbi in Lublin, he studied in Lublin. Where did he study? That's right. Anybody who's been to Lublin, which I have not, would know there is a very important, prominent, and famous yeshiva in Lublin, probably the most famous Jewish place in Lublin, is this famous yeshiva called Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin that was headed by previously Rabbi Meir Shapira, and then at the time of the outbreak of the war there was a man, one of the last Rosh Yeshiva, his name was Rav Aryeh Leib Fromer, author of Responsa Shilas and Tshuvas Eretz Tzvi, known as the Kozhiklov Rav, because he was from a small town called Kozhiklov. Same way that Weitzner Rav was known as Weitzner because of his town. So he was known as the Kozhiklov Rav, and that's why Rav Meir Shapira, the founder of this learning institution, was known as the Lubliner Rav. So it's based on where he's from. So this young man, Rav Tzvi Elimelech Talmud, so he was born in 1912, so you could do the math exactly how old he was at the outbreak of the war, was a rabbi in Lublin. And after the Lublin ghetto was opened in 1941, he served on the Judenrat. This Rav Tzvi Elimelech Talmud. He survived the March-April 1942 deportations, where most of the Jews were taken to Belzec, and then he was moved to a ghetto called the Majdan Tatarsky ghetto, which was situated between Lublin and a subcamp of Majdanek, right? Majdanek is a death camp right near Lublin. He continued to serve on the Judenrat, this graduate of the Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin, in Lublin through August 1942, and because he was a rabbinic figure, he also performed the religious functions in Lublin, in the ghetto. That meant weddings, divorces, religious disputes. So he's acting as what we would call a dayan. This little camp that he was in was liquidated on November 19th, 1942, and then he was taken to Majdanek, where he was murdered probably sometime in 1943, around there. So this is the story of one rabbi. But what's fascinating about this rabbi, among many, is that we have a letter, and that is what you have on pages 8 and 9. We have a letter that was written in October of 1942 to Chaim Aryeh Berglas, who was a young man who had been born in Krakow and studied in the yeshiva of Chachmei Lublin. So here you have two young rabbinic stars who are corresponding with each other. And when are they corresponding with each other? They're corresponding with each other in October of 1942. And so this is an unusually incredible and rare document, because this is the original letter that Rabbi Talmud sent to Rabbi Berglas, and it is a theological letter. It's a letter between friends, but it's a letter between yeshiva bachrim, two old yeshiva friends. When is it written? It's written at a time, not in 1939 and not in 1940, in October of 1942. What does he know?
He's going to die.
And it's not just that he's going to die, he knows what's happening, right? What's happening at this point? That there is a systematic program of death happening. So what does a rabbi say, and what does a rabbi think when he talks to his friend in October of 1942? So one of the things they talk about are mutual friends. He writes, and we're not going to go through the whole letter. I gave you the Xerox, even though it's all in Hebrew, and even the Hebrew, some of it is hard to understand. Some of it is rabbinic, like flourish. Some of it are verses that are couched in rabbinic Hebrew, and some of it just, even the words are hard to understand, this typeface. But he says, you know, I sent a letter to Rabbi so-and-so to see how he's doing, and I didn't hear back from him. I sent money to such and such a person because they're rabbinic colleagues, so they know, oh, what about the rabbi in that neighborhood, and what about the rabbi in this neighborhood? But the bulk of the letter is Rabbi Talmud pouring out his soul to his friend. And he describes to him, he says, I know I'm not such a, you know, an unusual person. I'm not better than anybody else. But he says, I can't understand how this is happening. He's talking about his one son, his prodigious son, who he had such great high hopes for, this young rabbinic second generation budding scholar. Talks about all the people that they know. And he's facing the prospect that we now know he's facing it contemporaneously. Because he says, at one point in the letter, he says, you know, people used to think, he says, part of me doesn't even feel as bad for the people who were taken in the early transports because they didn't suffer so much. You know what happened? They thought, what did they think?
They were going to work.
That's it. So they didn't even know that their fate was
immediate
death. So they went. It was a hardship. They got there and they were killed. He said, but we're living every day knowing that this is a systematic program of death. It's an inexorable march to the crematoria. Remember, he's living in the shadow of Maidanek. So he knows what's happening. It's an unbelievable letter. Because on the one hand, he questions God. His heart is broken about God. On the other hand, he validates God. He's in discussions with God. He's having that struggle together with God. It's a very poignant letter. What's the context? He writes to Rabbi Berglas, he says, you know, I couldn't get back to you earlier. I couldn't write back to you earlier. Why couldn't I write back to you earlier? Well, when is the date of this letter? October 1942. What's happening in the life of Rabbi Talmud in Lublin that he was so busy in September of 1942? That's it. The high holidays. So he writes in the beginning of the letter, he says, on the fourth line on page 8, if you want to follow in the Hebrew, page 8, you see it's the long type Hebrew page. Last words on the line of the third line, Avol Yemei, first word on the fourth line. Avol Yemei Haratzon Sha'avru Aleinu Ve'Alai,
Hayalahachin es atzmi, aleph ayin es atzmi, lios tfilasi, shigura befi kezaken veragil. He says, you know why I couldn't write back to you? Because these previous days, yemei ratzon, the days of connection and love of God, I had to prepare myself that my prayers should be regular in my lips. Why does he have to prepare? Because, he says, because ad hayom, meodi ad hayom, I never had the opportunity until today, lios shliach tzibur, to be the chazan, lefnei kahal ve'eda b'yamim hanoraim. He says, I had to be the chazan because no one else. I'm the rabbi. Now, he says, in my youth, I never trained to be a chazan. I never learned all the tunes and all the prayers. So the reason I couldn't write back to you is because I was busy preparing for the days of awe to be the chazan in Lublin on Rosh Hashanah 1942. Think about what he's saying and think about what he's about to say. He's about to say, I don't understand God. I don't get it. I simply cannot comprehend what's happening to me. At all. But that's not going to take away from my commitment to believing in God, to engaging God, and to serving God. And so on the next page, he says, thank God, on the second to last paragraph, and this is going to bring us back to conclude our presentation. Second to last paragraph, Va'ata odiacha, now I will tell you, ki hachagim avru aleinu be'ezrat Hashem b'mnucha, the holidays went off okay. Peacefully. Hitpalalu, where did we daven? B'mekomos achadim. In certain places, we found a little place over here and a little place over there. We did pray. Va'af hakitzonim sheba machane, even the extremists in the camp.
Meaning the Nazis?
No, meaning the Jews who were not religious and some even anti-religious, the kitzonim, the extremists, even they. Shemeolam lo erichu reach tefila betzibur, that they never ever even smelled the scent of coming to a synagogue, even on the high holy days. These so distant Jews, even they, shaktu ubo kulam lebeit tefila, they came to pray on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. They came to daven with us, and he says not just for Yizkor. He said, "Lo laskaras neshamas bilvad." Not just did they come to pray for Yizkor to remember the dead. Ki im b'meshach kol hatfilos. All the prayers.
So the Jews from Western Europe who were in the camps, were their religious experience the same as the Jews from Eastern Europe?
It's a great question. I don't think I'm educated enough to answer that question authoritatively, except to say that it would probably depend, number one, on the place where they ended up. It would depend on the environment in which they were in and their own personal background. So we would need to check on what happened with Western European Jews who were deported, whether they were German Jews,
French.
Yeah, we've spoken about the Dutch Jews, you know, the Dutch Jews who came through Westerbork. We did talk about last year on Hanukkah, and we spoke about the Hanukkah experience of Dutch Jews in the transit of Westerbork.
Right.
So I don't know if I certainly couldn't authoritatively give a whole answer.
Because their Holocaust experience up until the end, it was somewhat different.
Right, and the same thing, by the way, for Italian Jews.
Right.
Was definitely different because many of the Italian Jews succeeded in hiding.
Right.
So you know, everybody has a different kind of experience. But what I thought was so powerful about this, and which is why I wanted to close with this, is if you talk about the high holidays, as we started, you're talking not just about the struggle of religious observance. You're talking about the time when you're supposed to be mostly focusing on God. And here you have a person who is
a rabbi, perhaps the rabbi of the community, who's struggling openly with his friend, with his basic connection with God and understanding the way that God works in the world. And even with all of those questions, those personal deep questions, those deep theological problems that didn't stop him from believing in God and even observing and leading the community as a chazan, which he says he never did before in the high holiday service. Yeah.
So, historically, do you know or did you find the person that he wrote the letter to, where was that person living?
Yes.
And how did the letter survive in the sense that did this person was he having a similar experience to the rabbi, or was he like in Israel or something? Was he free and not therefore understanding the situation?
It's a great question. So two things. So first of all, I got this letter and I want to give public hakaras hatov and thanks. Professor Zilberschlag at Yad Vashem sent me this letter, and I asked him permission if I could use it for teaching, and he said yes, and I said I would gladly give him a thank you. So thanks to Yad Vashem for this. There is a great article on this letter and another letter to give you more context by a professor in Washington, D.C. His name is Gershon Greenberg. And the article is entitled, you can Google it and find it. I think it was published in a journal from the U.S. Holocaust Museum. He's a professor in American University, also at Bar Ilan for a while in Hebrew U. It's called, quote, The Theological Letters of Rabbi Talmud of Lublin, Summer-Fall 1942.
Theological Letters
of Rabbi Talmud of Lublin by Gershon Greenberg. So, he doesn't tell you too much, and I didn't look more beyond this of this Chaim Aryeh Berglass. I probably could look him up in Yad Vashem and see more about him. Yeah.
How are they able to get letters back and forth? There was no postal service.
Right, so there were people who were going, and you'll find there are correspondents. I just picked up this past year, someone showed me a book, what was it called? Last Letters of the Shoah, also published by Yad Vashem. So there was some semblance of communication that was going on. And so this letter, it's in Yad Vashem, but also has access in the back of this, which is where I first tried to get a hold of this letter, is from a place called Shem Olam, which is in Kfar Haroeh in Israel, where they have a whole center on religious studies in the Holocaust. So he is indebted to Dr. Avraham Krieger from there and David Zilberschlag from Yad Vashem. So I'm not sure who got it first, but if you look on the letter there, it sounds like it came originally from somewhere in Lublin. You see there's a stamp on the back of it. So all in all, I think those of us who are planning to observe the high holidays this year, we could take with us a measure of strength in knowing that we are continuing a tradition that has been unbroken even in the most serious and dire circumstance, and that can help to inform and inspire us as we go through the Yamim Noraim. Yeah.
In 1982.